history who have managed to overthrow the kind of oppressor that Israel is, the kind of vicious oppressor that Israel ideologically is, by peaceful means. And we've not seen any evidence for the Western powers or the UN or any of the apparatus controlled by the Anglo-Zionist Empire in really being serious to create any solution for Palestinians. Okay. We're seeing more of the same. It has to be a military resistance which is going to ultimately achieve Israel's downfall.
And on that note, thank you both for being with me on this spotlight. Sarah Flanders from the International Action Center out of New York, Said Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator out of London. And thank you for being with us on another spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Goodbye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 146 to 148 of chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parisgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Wa ka'ayyim min nabiyyin qatala ma'ahu ربيون كثير فما وهنوا لما أصابهم في سبيل الله وما ضعفوا وما استكانوا والله يحب الصابرين وما كان قولهم إلا أن قالوا ربنا اغفر لنا ذنوبنا وإسرافنا في أمرنا ربنا اغفر لنا ذنوبنا وإسرافنا في أمرنا وثبت أقدامنا ربنا اغفر لنا ذنوبنا وإسرافنا إسرافنا في أمرنا وثبت أقدامنا وانصرنا على القوم الكافرين فآتاهم الله ثواب الدنيا وحسن ثواب الآخرة والله يحب المحسنين فآتاهم الله ثواب الدنيا وحسن ثواب الآخرة والله يحب المحسنين.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. And how many a prophet has fought with whom were many worshippers of the Lord? So they did not become weak-hearted on account of what befell them in Allah's way, nor did they weaken, nor did they abase themselves. And Allah loves the patient. And their saying was no other than that they said, Our Lord, forgive us our faults and our extravagance in our affair, and make firm our feet and help us against the unbelieving people. So Allah gave them the reward of this world and better reward of the hereafter. And Allah loves those who do good to others.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza continues for the 165th day, with the death toll surpassing 31,700, mostly women and children. France's UN envoy says the Gaza situation is absolutely catastrophic, urging the international body to overcome its inaction and declare an immediate ceasefire. And Israeli occupation forces carry out night raids on several areas of the West Bank, abducting at least two young Palestinians. Thanks for joining us. Israel presses ahead with its bombing campaign in the Gaza Strip, claiming the lives of more civilians in the besieged territory. The regime bombed several residential buildings across Gaza, killing dozens of civilians. To the north, at least 8 people were killed in the town of Jabalia. Another 6 were killed when the regime's jets and forces bombed homes in Gaza City. Several people were also killed when a building was targeted in the Nusayrat camp in central Gaza. To the south, regime forces killed over a dozen people in a new attack on the densely populated city of Rafah, where over 1.5 million displaced Palestinians have sought shelter. The death toll in Gaza has surpassed 31,700, including at least 30 people who have died of malnutrition. Condemnations are pouring in following the Israeli regime's attack on Al-Shifa Hospital that left dozens of Palestinians killed or wounded. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman said Israel's repeated attacks on hospitals are a blatant violation of international law and the most fundamental humanitarian principles. Nasser Kanani said over the last 6 months, Israel's long list of crimes against Palestinians, including occupation, assassination, violence, and hostage-taking, has grown to include genocide. Earlier, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas also said attacks on health centers will not give Israel any semblance of a victory. Outgoing Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammad Shtayyeh also slammed the international community for its inaction against Israel. The head of the World Health Organization also described the attack as deeply concerning, warning of the risk to health workers, patients, and civilians. Many Palestinians were also abducted during the latest raids by Israeli forces on Al-Shifa, the largest hospital in Gaza. We spoke to Tim Anderson, the director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies in Sydney. He argues that Israel wants to push the Palestinians in Gaza into full evacuation.
Really, Hamas is just the tip of the Palestinian resistance iceberg, and that's not going to go away anytime soon, basically. But when you're talking about Al-Shifa, remember also this is a hospital that was devastated before. It's in the north, in Gaza City. There are still civilians there, even though conditions of life have been very difficult in the areas. All of the residential areas being devastated around there. There also is resistance there. The resistance is back in areas where the Israelis thought they'd got rid of them. So the civilians are there. And really, of course, this idea that they're actually going after Hamas is only part of the story. Anyway, let's remember that they have said many times to us, you know, and this is what the South Africans have carried to the International Court of Justice. They want to destroy the conditions of life to make it unbearable. They want to destroy the people or drive them out. And of course, this new port that the US is involved in is widely suspected now of being a way to try and evacuate and take Palestinians out of Gaza to help with the ethnic cleansing of the area. So the assault on civilians has always been a openly stated part of this genocide. Very few genocides in the past have openly stated as clearly as the Israelis have this one.
France's ambassador and the permanent representative to the United Nations has called on the Security Council to take action on the dire situation in Gaza.
So far, the Security Council has only been able to adopt two humanitarian resolutions, which, by the way, are not implemented. These councils need to do more, to do it now, and take up its responsibility. It cannot wait any longer. So this is why France requested close consultation on the situation in Gaza today. We want the members of this council to have a honest conversation on which measures can be taken by this council to stop this conflict. Well, we are supposed to take different steps. Now, the emergency is to do what I just said, an immediate ceasefire during Ramadan, release of hostages and full humanitarian access. So this is what the Security Council should do now, not next week. I'm talking about the next 24 or 48 hours. There is no reason to procrastinate further. No reason.
Rivière also described the humanitarian situation in the besieged Palestinian territory as absolutely catastrophic. He argued that this is not a natural disaster, but a war that should stop now, and that the Security Council cannot continue to procrastinate. France has been pushing for a ceasefire in Israel's war in Gaza. However, 15-member UN body has failed to pass resolutions due to constant U.S. vetoes. Over the past 5 months, since Israel launched its genocidal war in Gaza, Washington has vetoed three draft resolutions, two of which had demanded an immediate ceasefire. The former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert has hailed the U.S. Senate Majority Leader for urging early Israeli elections to replace the regime's current Premier Benjamin Netanyahu. Olmert sent a letter to Chuck Schumer several days after the Democratic Senator called Netanyahu a major obstacle to peace in Gaza. The former Israeli premier lauded Schumer for his courage to express how traditional supporters of Israel feel today. Olmert added that Netanyahu is unable to fulfill the responsibilities assigned to him. Schumer's call for the replacement of Netanyahu was also praised by Israeli opposition leader Yair Lapid. He said that Netanyahu is losing Israel's biggest supporters. Schumer's remarks have signaled a widening rift between the Israeli regime and the U.S., a country that has been complicit in the Gaza genocide. The call for a snap election has angered Netanyahu, who responded by saying that Israel is not a banana republic. We're going to now cross on over to Deir al-Bala and talk to our correspondent Muti Abu Musaba to get the latest on developments there in the Gaza Strip. Muti, what do you have for us?
Actually, the Israeli genocide is still continued and maintained here in the Gaza Strip. As you know, that the Israeli occupation forces over the last night continued their air strikes and their incursions against several areas of Gaza Strip. Those areas actually were intensified here Let's begin from Rafah City, as the Israeli occupation forces committed an appalling massacre after targeting several residential buildings. At least five residential buildings were destroyed in Ashabura and Al-Barazil neighborhoods, claiming the lives of at least 14 Palestinian civilians, mostly women and children. While here in the central area of Gaza Strip, a Nusrat refugee camp was hit relentlessly by the Israeli warplanes. Another residential buildings were destroyed. Two residential buildings actually were destroyed in the east, in the western part of the camp, claiming the lives of at least the three Palestinian civilians, whereas the eastern part of the central area of Gaza Strip were hit cruelly by the Israeli artillery shelling that reached and targeted Al Burij refugee camp and even the southern part of Deir el-Balah city. When it comes to Gaza, as you know, that Gaza city was under heavy bombardments over the last couple of days, and the last night was cruel for the Palestinian people as the Israeli war planes continued their air strikes and their incursions against the western parts of the city. Al-Rimal, Sheikh Ridwan, and Al-Nasr neighborhoods were under heavy bombardments and attacks of those air strikes. Dozens of the Palestinian residential buildings were destroyed, leaving dozens of the Palestinian casualties. In the meantime, the Israeli tanks that are still circumventing the Shiva Square opened their heavy gunfire towards the residential buildings there. And, it was reported that hundreds of the Palestinian families are still stranded in that area as the Israeli occupation tanks are still surrounding that area with heavy gunfire, as I've mentioned. In the meantime, the eastern parts of the city, Gaza City, were subjected also to heavy attacks of the Israeli artillery. When it comes to the northern part of Gaza Strip, particularly Jabalia refugee camp, the Israeli occupation forces committed another crime after targeting a warehouse that contains the humanitarian aid of the UNRWA that are supposed to be distributed to the people there. Two Palestinian civilians were reportedly killed as a result of that airstrike, of that attack. So we are talking about continuous airstrikes. Those airstrikes actually are intensified until this moment, by the way, against the western parts of Gaza City and even the center of Al-Nusayrat refugee camp, the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital. The people are began actually to gather in order to bid farewell to those Palestinian civilians who were killed over the last night, as usual. So the Palestinian civilians are still being killed day and night by the Israeli continuous and relentless airstrikes and attacks, while the humanitarian conditions on the ground are still exacerbating with the time, as the Israeli policy is still constant in terms of stalling and procrastinating the entry of those humanitarian aid to the people. And they are, as we have mentioned, they are deliberately and systematically attacking those humanitarian aid and the people who are waiting for the humanitarian aid. The last crime was in Jabalia, and over the last couple of weeks, as you know, that the Palestinian civilians near Al-Kuwait and Nablusi roundabout were targeted heavily by the Israeli airstrikes, and even the people there, and according to multiple international and human rights organizations and the bodies, that the Israeli occupation forces are deliberately and systematically stalling and preventing the smooth delivery of those humanitarian aid to the needy people in a way that deepens and widens the suffering of the Palestinian people.
Thank you for that, Muti Abu Musaba from Deir al-Balah. Thank you, Muti. The Israeli military has carried out fresh raids across the occupied West Bank as the regime presses ahead with its offensive against Palestinians. In the latest such attacks, Israeli forces raided the town of Yamoun west of the city of Jenin, as well as a Palestinian refugee camp east of the city of Nablus. Regime forces abducted several people after storming Palestinian homes. Clashes also erupted between Israeli troops and resistance forces, which targeted soldiers and bulldozers with explosive devices. The Israeli military has intensified its violent raids across the West Bank since October 7, the day when the regime launched its genocidal war in Gaza. Hundreds of Palestinians have been killed and thousands abducted during Israeli incursions into the occupied towns and cities ever since. Our Ramallah correspondent Monica Ndil says Israeli troops have conducted new raids on several towns, villages, and refugee camps across the occupied West Bank.
Raided several areas across the occupied West Bank, speaking from the south to the north of the occupied West Bank, raiding villages, towns, and refugee camps. The soldiers stormed a number of Palestinian homes and caused destruction inside the homes and the properties, and clashes, exchange of fire have taken place between the Israeli forces and members of the resistance groups. The Israeli forces raided Al-Jalazon refugee camp near Ramallah and arrested a Palestinian female journalist, Rola Hassanein. She's a mother and a wife, and she was arrested by the Israeli forces. It's not clear why she had been detained, but today we are speaking about 70 Palestinians were detained, 70 Palestinian journalists were detained by the Israeli forces since the 7th of October. At least over 35 of them are still being held by the Israeli forces. The Israeli troops also stormed Qalqilia and arrested at least three Palestinians there. The Israeli military had also carried out an operation in Nablus, mainly in the Balata refugee camp. And according to the Palestinian resistance, exchange of fire had taken place for several hours between the Israeli troops and the Palestinian fighters.
Israeli warplanes have carried out fresh airstrikes on Syria, targeting the Damascus countryside. According to the Syrian military, the missiles were launched from the direction of the occupied Golan Heights and targeted a number of military locations. It added that the country's air defenses intercepted and shot down some of the missiles, noted that the rest only caused material damage. The Israeli regime frequently targets the war-ravaged Arab country, particularly areas in and around Damascus. The Syrian government has, on numerous occasions, called on the United Nations to force the Israeli regime to stop its acts of aggression. Damascus says the adults are in violation of international law and aimed at propping up terrorists. Iran is marking the 73rd anniversary of the nationalization of its oil industry. That was a turning point in the political and economic history of the Iranian nation to save the national treasure from foreigners. Fatemeh Masumi has the details.
20th, 1951, members of the Iranian parliament passed a bill introduced by the country's democratically elected prime minister, Mohammad Mossadegh, to nationalize Iran's oil industry. The groundbreaking initiative put an end to Britain's four-decade dominion over Iran's oil industry. The Britain-owned Anglo-Iranian Oil Company enjoyed a monopolistic control over the industry and paid only a meager portion of the revenues to the Iranian government.
Nationalization was a call for independence. If you go back then, the Iranians, the entire public, realized that this move was not about economy. It was about independence. And ergo, the Mossadegh movement was very popular within, and the entire world realized that it was about gaining independence from a colonial power that controlled the economy and based on the economy, controlled the political spectrum within Iran.
When the then government of Mossadegh put the nationalizing of Iran's oil on its agenda in April 1951, acts of sabotage and conspiracy against the country were enhanced. The American-British coup in August 1953 against Mossadegh's government was part of the plot.
Basically, the British were plundering Iranian natural resources, and oil was at the top of the list. Iranians began to protest, and there was a growing social movement in the country to nationalize Iranian oil. When that ultimately happened, the British imposed sanctions on the country, similar to what happened after the revolution in Iran.
After the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Iran achieved significant milestones in the petroleum industry. These include the discovery of numerous oil and gas fields, an expansion in extractable oil and condensate reserves, a rise in oil production and extractable gas, and the discovery of new oil and gas fields. Iran was the first country in the West Asia to reclaim its oil industry. The Iranian nation's move proved to be of great importance in giving rise to the anti-colonialist tendencies all over the region and set a trend for other countries. Fateh Masumi, Tehran.
And that does it for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
The supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it. And leave no grief unless Thou takes it away. And leave no enemy. And leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O Patron of Beneficence.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we said that a review of Imam Khomeini's views, scientific works and behavior indicate that a very effective and important source of his success was his sincerity. In other words, Imam Khomeini did all his deeds absolutely for God's satisfaction, and he never thought of what others would think or like. To be more clear, the great leader of the Islamic Revolution only tried to fulfill his obligations and avoid forbidden acts. He used to warn that being trapped by satanic temptations stems from the lack of sincerity. He used to call on the youth to have sincerity and do everything for God's sake. It is good to give an example to show his sincerity. Years before the Islamic Revolution, a book was written by Ahmad Hekamizadeh, which was an evident insult to Islam and Muslims. The book was titled Asrar Hezar Sale, meaning 1,000 Year Secrets. The Imam wrote a book titled Kashful Asrar, meaning Exposure of Secrets, to show the true intention of the author and to negate the profane content of the book. But surprisingly, Imam Khomeini didn't let the publisher write his name on the book. Yet, this very act made the Imam famous among the ulema and the faithful. This is an obvious instance of the hadith which reads, "Whoever is for Allah, Allah will be for him." Another outstanding characteristic of Imam Khomeini was that he hated and even got angry with being praised. He used to say that God will reward our deeds if we have done them for him. So there is no need to seek people's praise and satisfaction. Many memoirs have been mentioned on his severe reaction against those who tried to extol him. Another merit of the Imam was that he followed his great ancestor, the Prophet of Islam, to greet people in advance. In other words, he used to be the first to greet whomever he encountered. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, was also apologetic if he made a mistake. This modest characteristic made him great in the eyes of others. At times, he would even seek apology for what he was not guilty of. And in fact, it were some of the officials who had come short of their duties and caused problems for the government or the people. He was so modest that he had ordered the officials to refrain from mentioning his name much on TV and radio. And speak of the successes and honors of the nation and the Islamic Revolution instead. Another merit of Imam Khomeini was his sociability and good behavior with all walks of life. According to the Islamic teachings, a faithful should be smiling while facing others. This was very clear in the Imam's contact with others, except those who were the avowed enemies of Islam and the hypocrites. Imam Khomeini used to smile even at the most critical and toughest junctures of the eight-year war. The friends, pupils, and relatives of the Imam say that he had even a sense of humor in gatherings and his classes. This might look contradictory in a man who was so strict, resolute, and uncompromising against the enemies. But it is a characteristic of great men of history like Imam Ali, peace upon him. And Imam Khomeini was a true follower of Imam Ali. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, was very patient at tough conditions and pains. This was evident during several times of his surgeries. Another high virtue of the Imam was his control of anger. In other words, he was very forbearing and would never get angry for personal issues. The Imam was patient in the face of those who had disrespected him, but would be very harsh at those who insulted Islam or an Islamic value. Imam Khomeini was very brave and decisive and would not fear anyone or any power when defending Islam. He was also very wise, orderly, and disciplinary in handling different daily issues. This did not mean rigidity, but it meant that he deemed high importance to the time of his pupils and anyone who wanted to see and contact with him. He used to instruct young students of seminaries to stick to orderliness and discipline in their courses and activities. He would also emphasize the importance of respecting the teachers and great ulama who had left behind very precious books and trained great generations of seminary students.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Eye on Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Each week we evaluate a trending news story and break it down from an Islamic perspective. Muslims around the world are engaging in a month of worship and fasting, but they do so in the shadow of the ongoing genocide against the people of Palestine. In this week's episode, we'll look at what actions Muslims and others have been taking and will continue to take during the holy month of Ramadan to support and campaign for the people of Gaza. First, we take a look at some of the actions that have brought the attention of the world to the crimes of the Zionist regime.
The past 5 months have seen a number of actions taking place around the world in support of Palestine against the Zionist entity, and those are expected to continue throughout the holy month of Ramadan. In years gone past, there have been campaigns during Shahar Ramadan surrounding dates, asking believers to ensure the dates they have for their iftar aren't Israeli. This year, the Islamic Human Rights Commission's Check Your Dates campaign takes on extra significance as they've released a list of date brands that are certified to be Palestinian. The Zionist regime regularly labels their stolen dates as Jordanian or from the West Bank, or sells them on the supermarket brands without always mentioning the country of origin. So the campaign urges believers to constantly ensure that they're checking their brands. Other campaigns are focusing on exerting financial pressure on the Zionist entity and its supporters. Barclays Bank in particular has come into focus as campaigners call for a boycott of the British financial institution due to the more than £1 billion they've invested in the Zionist economy. Another major company which has come under fire has been Starbucks, who sued the workers' union when they declared their solidarity with Palestine. The global coffee giant has been targeted by protests and boycotts ever since, severely hurting the company's bottom line. While a painting of the man behind the Balfour decoration, Lord Balfour, was destroyed by campaigners at the University of Cambridge. Perhaps the most impactful actions have been undertaken by the Palestine Action Group, who have managed to bring to a halt the activities of a number of facilities belonging to the Israeli weapons manufacturer Elbit Systems, forcing them in many instances to close down their factories completely. All these actions and so many more have heaped immense pressure on Israel and its supporters across the world, highlighting their barbaric and savage nature, stripping away any vestige that they are in any way a civilized or moral people.
Now joining us on the show this week to discuss the importance of activism against oppression, especially during Shahr Ramadan, are two very special guests. We're joined by Fatima Merchant, who has years of experience in organizing demonstrations for causes in Palestine, Nigeria, Yemen, and others. She has been an avid campaigner for human rights and is the co-host of the Liberated Voices podcast. We're also joined by Brother Ibrahim Abul Asad. Ibrahim is a UK-based Palestinian researcher, photojournalist, and activist. Assalamu alaikum to you both. Thank you so much for joining us on Eye on Islam. Sister Fatima, if I could begin with you, what has been your experience of the Muslim reaction in the UK, particularly to the ongoing genocide in Gaza?
Well, as we know that this didn't start on October 7th, there has been a huge shift in attitudes, particularly within the Muslim communities. I think it's clear to see that instead of it being seen as more of a political issue, it's now become one that is seen as humanitarian, as it should be, especially with the lead up to, you know, and now, alhamdulillah, we are in Shahr Ramadan. It's become more mainstream within the Muslim community, as it should be. There is still a lot more that could be done.
Absolutely. Ibrahim, there is a lot of variety in the actions to be taken. We've seen, you know, from cultural events to boycott campaigns. In your opinion, what are the most effective ways to campaign against the Zionist regime during this holy month?
First and foremost, I'd like to say Happy Ramadan. To answer bluntly, to mobilise and campaign outside these arms factories that make the weapons that are used to kill Palestinians as well as many oppressed people across the global south. And as well, not just these arms factories, but to apply pressure upon all the pressure points that Zionism has here in the UK. Now, what is that? Universities. They have a substantial amount of deals with companies that create weapons as well as components or have different types of investments in occupied Palestine. So what we really need to do now is up our level, up our game when it comes to applying pressure upon these pressure points, upon these institutions that are Zionist, that work towards Israel's effort to occupy, Israel's effort to kill, Israel's effort to displace, Israel's effort to maim Palestinians from the river to the sea.
I mean, just quickly, you mentioned, obviously, universities. What could some students do? Let's say there were students watching this. What are some effective things that maybe they could do on their campuses?
Well, not just students, but everybody needs to know the political climate that we need to operate in. Now, it being students, we need to know what is a Zionist organization, what are Zionist organizations that are present at campus, on campus. And one organization that every single student and pro-Palestinian advocate needs to know about is the UJS, the Union of Jewish Students, that works towards demonizing and in an effort criminalizing Palestinians as well as students that are literally advocating for the right belonging to the Palestinian people. Very important point is that Nina Friedman, who was the former UJS president, has spoken on video at an event full of UJS alumni. She clearly says, not my words, Nina Friedman's words, that the UJS alumni have members in the Israeli military, the Israeli political office, different bureaucracies within Israel. So how is the UJS not clearly an extension of Zionism here in the UK? Students need to know who the UJS is. Anytime that you see a UJS event, you go to your local PALSOC, you inform them. You go to PALSOC such as that you see in SOAS University, that you see in UCL, as well as that you see in countless other London-based universities and non-London-based universities, and demand that any event organised by the UJS or Zionist organisations should not be held on our campus.
No, absolutely. And Fatima, I would say... just before we, you know, move on to some of the spiritual dimensions, do you think Muslims have been doing enough? I mean, do you think that as a community in general, we see the young generally are more maybe mobilised and active and on campuses and doing stuff. Do you think maybe we could be doing more?
Absolutely, you should be doing more. Especially as a student, you've got that position where you can be doing more. Within universities, there is so much opportunity to stand up, especially because these are the institutions that are complicit, you know, and essentially you're paying the university and the university is paying to kill. So absolutely you should be doing more. The students should be standing up, not just in the ways previously discussed, but there's this campaign of silencing going on. Wearing even the Palestinian badge or having any sort of political standpoint can be demonised, although it's not legal. That's where you need to understand that if it's not illegal,
don't be intimidated and do it. And I guess, you know, we've spoken already about some of the physical material actions that we can take. What are some of the spiritual actions or some spiritual dimensions to this struggle that Muslims can engage in specifically during Shahr Ramadan?
Absolutely. So, as we've seen in Rafah, the children, they look up to the sky and they don't know whether it's dinner or death.
Right?
It's a devastating situation. And so, when we are fasting, usually we think, okay, we are doing this for patience, we are doing this to have sabr, to find that inner peace. These Palestinian children, they've been doing it for months now.
Yeah.
And if we can't empathise with them, not just on a material level, but on a spiritual level, then what are we doing? We need to look within us, and as we are fasting, we need to find that spiritual side within us that empathises with these kids in Gaza, that empathises with the struggles that these people can't have a break from. There is no iftar. There is nothing, I mean, grinding up animal feed... Subhanallah, and here we are thinking that we might have dates from Israel, and who cares?
Yeah,
it's horrendous. So when you're doing your zikr, when you're doing your fast, when you're going about your daily life and you think, oh, I'm hungry, oh, I feel thirsty, find that part of you that connects with the rest of the ummah on a spiritual level.
Yeah, and quickly, Ibrahim, do you think that we, as Muslims, sometimes underestimate the power of da'a? Like, you know, maybe some people say, oh, pray for the people of Palestine, but actually it's a power, it's the weapon of the believer as far as we understand.
100%, as much as we must always pray for the people of Palestine, we should also must make an act of duty in, for example, making sure that we are not breaking our fast on Israeli-produced dates that was produced on stolen Palestinian land. Of course, we should always pray for the people of Gaza, but we should also make sure that we are not...
That
our actions are in line with our prayer, and they don't contradict, because quite frankly, it's very bittersweet. Very bittersweet that we're breaking and we're surrounding by our loved members, our family members, while Palestinians are surrounded by the rubble of their homes, eating animal feed, breathing in white phosphorus for breakfast. It's disgusting, and quite frankly, it's harrowing. And I think what we saw recently, seeing a mosque in London invite genocide enabler Rishi Sunak, in my opinion, is quite disgusting. Because I don't think any individual that has advocated for the killing of any people, regardless of their religion or regardless of their race or creed, for profit...
should be welcome anyway. Yeah.
Whether it be this room, my house, your house, and my religious centre or your religious centre.
Absolutely, absolutely. No, absolutely. Thank you. Now, with the large-scale crackdown, as we've mentioned, touched on student action on campuses across the UK, Ayan Islam attended a pro-Palestine fundraising event at a London university and heard from the students directly as to why they planned this action specifically during the holy month of Ramadan.
In my opinion, being proactive and standing for justice is inherently Islamic. And so I think it's something that we actually need to do. With regard to it being public or private, I think what we're doing here today isn't necessarily something that you need to be a Muslim to do. Even though we said it's inherently Islamic, if people differ to that, then you can turn around and say, well, look, this is a humanitarian cause. And I don't think anyone has any valid basis to use how public or private their religious beliefs are to stand with what's right.
I'm first year law student. I'm also president of the SJP Society, Students for Justice in Palestine. And we're here today because we've seen that individual efforts aren't enough. We need more combined efforts. So that's why we've come, we've coalitioned with different societies, and we're trying to make a big scene here so that we can really get our message across. We've tried our best to communicate with the university, express how unhappy we've been that they've been neglecting the issue of Palestine. They haven't shown enough attention to it. They haven't respected our requests. We've asked them to raise the flag like they do for other causes. They haven't respected our request, basically. So we're going to try our best to put on a scene here and display the flag everywhere possible and keep chanting Free Palestine.
We feel to a point pushed to have to do something. There's now a coalition of societies. It started off as two or three societies, but we're now, I think, 15 or 16 societies in total have come together. So it's clearly something which is supported by a very broad and large element of the student base. And there's even academic staff, members of staff, who have voiced their solidarity with the cause as well, and the fact that they want to see things that are different. But we've heard they've been outright scared to do so. One member of staff earlier today came and slapped this on the wall and actually told us. You know, we had a conversation with him afterwards. He was genuinely scared. He was trying to conceal his identity. And he was a Jewish member of staff, which goes to show that this isn't, you know, just a Muslim cause. It's a global cause, it's a humanitarian cause, and I feel, like I said, when we started this, obligated to speak out. And I think most students are starting to see that as well.
Now, Fatima, we just saw some footage from an event there at a London university, and I think one of the things that came through from that event is attempts to intimidate students on campus to maybe make them feel like they could be harmed in their studying or their prospects, or some kind of consequences could come upon them. What advice would you have to particularly the younger students in terms of how to face down these attempts at intimidation, whether it be by extremists on campus, like Ibrahim was talking about, in the Union of Jewish Students, or even members of staff?
Of course. Well, first of all, well done to those students that put that action in place. That is what we need. You cannot feel intimidated by these people because they have no backing. There is no ground for them to stand on, essentially. For the younger students in particular, you've just now entered into a space where you've found this newfound power. And you need to recognise that as a student. A lot of student activism is undermined, but actually it plays a huge part in getting things done, in changing the way people see things, even in legislation. So it is so important that as a younger student, look to those that are older than you in perhaps higher years or even alumni, and see how they've interacted with the difficulties they faced. Because this isn't something new. We know that this issue has been ongoing. So there are sources and resources out there where you can look to, and you should find power and solidarity with the students that you're with, because now you're no longer just one, you're part of a bigger whole.
Yeah, you've got the critical mass.
Just to add on that note, I think to the students that are watching, to one organisation and one movement definitely worth following, and also asking for assistance if you do feel any trouble on campus, is YFFP, Youth Front for Palestine, based in the north of England, in Manchester, as well as PYM Britain, that is based in London. Because they are youth-led, they themselves have gone through many of these very similar experiences on the back of the UJS's efforts to demonise and criminalise anything of anybody calling for the rights belonging to the Palestinian people. So those two, what that organisation and the Palestinian Youth Movement, are amazing avenues to get in contact with if you are experiencing any form of trouble on campus and you need to speak to somebody more experienced that can help alleviate the situation.
Sorry, on that note, I think it's really important, actually, that students remember that they do have their rights. And as Ibrahim was saying, it is so important that you are educated in that sense. Mm. So when you are holding these actions, don't be intimidated because you have rights. So make sure you know them and therefore can use them.
Yes. Sure. And Ibrahim, I would want to come back to the question of, Shahr Ramadan and in terms of religiosity. What would you say to those who say that actually people or Muslims shouldn't be concerning themselves with political matters in general or even during this special time of the year?
Then I think it contradicts a lot of my own personal beliefs and as well as a lot of beliefs of the Muslim community when we see injustices unfolding across the world. I think I myself as a human being, I myself as a Muslim, I myself as Ibrahim cannot just sit there and continue to digest my food while a Palestinian boy is starving and has been starving for over 150 days and looks to the sky and doesn't know whether there's food coming from the above or if it's a bomb raining to steal the life of his mother, his brother, his sister, as well as his father. I think it's shameful. I think shameful. Yeah. Nothing. No other words to put in between. I think there's much more that Muslims themselves, as well as the Muslim community, are amazing in terms of what they have done for Palestine, yeah, as well as we need to take it many more steps further.
Sister Fatima, we've seen many reports of the British government's attempts to try to redefine extremism in order to maybe try to tamp down support for Palestine amongst people in the UK, Muslims and non-Muslims who have come out to support Palestine. Do you think they'll be successful in their attempts?
They've tried, and they've tried again, and we're still on the streets. So whilst, yes, we can see they are having an impact, people are starting to understand that it doesn't matter what they say or how many times they try to redefine extremism or how much they try to broaden it or how much they try to snatch you into this loop or that loop or this label or whatever. What actually matters is whether you are able to continue going out. Mm. So as long as we have that right and as long as this is a democratic country, you will have that right. So don't be intimidated. And I mean, they'll keep trying. They won't stop. They won't relax. Mm. But neither will we.
Yeah. Do you think they'll be successful, Ibrahim? But also, do you think that it's a sign of their desperation that they're trying to crack down in this way, that they maybe are worried about how much the narrative has changed? And, you know, especially the young generation. I just want to take it very quickly somewhere else. In America, there's a debate going on and expected to be passed very soon that TikTok will be banned.
Yes.
The main driving force of this, nothing to do, of course, with China and everything to do with the fact that the ADL, yes, the Jewish Extremist Organization, is worried that the younger generation who get their news from TikTok are seeing things how they are. And do you think this is what's reflected in government policy here? They're so panicking, especially that younger people are not supporting Israel anymore, that they're trying to all of this, ban protests and call people extremists to try to, because of how successful these actions have been.
100%. Just before starting off, I think the only extremist thing is what's coming out of the Cabinet Office and coming out of Rishi Sunak's mouth, the fact that he is supporting an entity that is committing genocide and actively spoke about their genocidal intent. I think with the question regarding TikTok, it's a very interesting question because we no longer have two camps where it is the left and the right. Instead, it is the old and the young. Mm. And the old will soon die and the young continue to get old. And the young have the dominant view that Palestine should be liberated from the river to the sea because they are seeing the injustices and their mind hasn't been tampered with institutionally by going through their ages of life. So I think that is very telling. I think what is very telling is the fact that protests, our right to protests, is what allowed us to have the establishment of the National Health Service here in this country. It was working class men going to go out to fight in World War II, coming back without a leg, without an arm, without any form of service, health-wise, taking to the streets, demanding their right. Given that I fought blood, sweat, and tears for your country, the least you can do is accommodate me in terms of healthcare. That is how we had the NHS. That is the same people that Boris Johnson wanted us to clap for at 8 o'clock. Mm-hmm. And you are now saying that you want to strip our right from protesting, mm-hmm. when protesting literally gave something that this country regards itself as one of its greatest achievements, a national free health service. And just to conclude, I think we shouldn't get lost in everything that's been taking place post October the 7th, thinking that it's happening in a vacuum. Because just like how it didn't take place on October the 7th, their attempts to criminalise Palestinian activity across Western Europe did not take place post October the 7th. This has been an effort to criminalising our right to protest before last year, and we see it accelerated in places like Germany, where organisations are unable to receive state funding if they support BDS, and we're soon on the trajectory to see that happening here in the UK. So none of this should be seen to have happened in a vacuum, whether it be the events that led up to October the 7th or the events that led after October the 7th.
And just very finally, Fatima, maybe actually I want to pick up on that last point that Brother Ibrahim made about funding. So, you know, there are attempts, and there have been actually legislation passed in many states in the US where you wouldn't get access to, you know, funds and contracts or other access to public money if you support BDS or you're anti-Zionist. Isn't that a good thing, though? I mean, what we really want is our communities to be independent from the state, right, and not be reliant on the state. Because we've seen many of those who do take money from the state, you know, to promote narratives like Prevent and others, have actually been very compromised. So in the long term, isn't it good that people divorce themselves from being reliant on these, you know, kind of authoritarian Western regimes?
I think I want to just flip that on its head quickly, because the way we look at it is so important. Mm. When you are given money by the state doesn't give it to you without its expectations.
Strings attached. Yeah, exactly.
So now Rishi's pledged, what, 117 million to the security of mosques and Muslim faith-based schools and whatever over the next 4 years. What does that come with? That's not just coming out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. There is a reason that it's coming out now, and there's a reason that it's this amount of money, and there's a reason that it's based to the Muslim community. Mm-hmm. When the Muslims have been vocal, now it's suddenly time to fund them, mm-hmm. to silence them, essentially. When we're all happy in our place and the Muslim community is more worried about spiritual issues rather than perhaps current affairs or the idea of, you know, Prevent is something to help us all and it's not biased or whatever. Well, when you're silent and you're already within their pocket, they don't need to buy you to put them in their pocket. Does that make sense?
It's
so important that not only are you scared, you shouldn't be scared of not receiving funding, you should be scared of receiving funding.
Yep.
Exactly.
Which has been my position, because what are the strings that come attached with it? Thank you so much, Sister Fatima, and Brother Ibrahim as well, for your time and your excellent contributions. And thank you. You can join us again next week for another edition of Eye on Islam. Assalamu alaikum.
Ayahs, 30 days. In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful, Salam and welcome to the program. A monotheist person not only reflects on the Quran, but also tries to explain the ayahs of this heavenly scripture to others and make them familiar with its teachings. Explicating of the Quranic teachings, first of all, was the duty of the Prophet and his infallible successors. Every faithful, too, according to the extent that they had learned from the Ahlul Bayt, embarked on this heavy duty. So the ulema, that are Muslim scholars, took over this duty after the occultation of the 12th infallible successor of the Prophet, Imam Mahdi, may God hasten his reappearance, and have seriously continued this job till the present day. Today, this duty has become highly important due to the broad assault of enemies against the beliefs of Islam and humanity. In the 8th episode of the Ramadan special series, we will speak about the clothes and chastity with a glance at several ayahs of Surah A'raf, especially ayahs 26 and 27 of this surah. Stay tuned, please. The parents of mankind, Adam and Eve, were living in paradise in calm and enjoying the bounties provided by God. However, God had prevented them from approaching a certain tree, lest they would be placed among wrongdoers. Nevertheless, Adam and Eve had an enemy, Satan. Satan had disobeyed God's order to prostrate out of arrogance and hence banished from paradise. Therefore, Satan swore by God to pervert all humans except God's exclusive servants. In view of this, Satan couldn't tolerate to see Adam and Eve in bliss and calm, so he went to them and swore to them to be their well-wisher. God says in Ayah 20 of Surah A'raf, "Then Satan tempted them to expose to them what was